This is the Freedom Fiends. Radio is dying, but we'll ride it to the ground, whooping and hollering with our hat waving like a Slim Pickens, like Slim Pickens at the end of Dr. Strangelove. We'll show those dirty commies like Obama what we're made of in a display of primo pulchritude and rejuvenative radio waves, which warm your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit. Keep a sin flood of statism out of your brain. Can you feel it, Ben Stone, the bad Quaker? Can you feel it?
I feel it, Michael.
Is it working?
How you doing today? It is working.
I'm all right. Kind of getting over being sick, but still kind of like, wet. I'm wet. I'm sweaty. I blame the government. I don't know. Maybe I just blame not living well in my earlier days and it's catching up. No, I'm good. Other than that, I'm mentally halfway here. And where are you and what are you doing?
I am in the deep, deep south near the Gulf Coast, and it is actually spring here. There are, like, you know, all the signs of spring. Flowers are blooming. Leaves are popping out everywhere. There's all types of creatures, big and small.
Squirrels are mating.
Oh, yeah. Squirrels are going nuts, and there's birds everywhere, and the gators are climbing up on the roads, licking their chops, looking for something, some little doggy to chew on.
Looking for someone to stop and change a tire. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So you and I have a thing about squirrels, and before we're going to get into some deep stuff here today, some deep mud. We're going to talk about the 11th step of Status Anonymous, but talk about squirrels for a little bit, Ben. People have made a lot of meme images of you and I and something about squirrels. Why?
I like squirrels. You know, I learned a lot from squirrels. I had, back around 2002 or 2003, I had some real serious health problems, and we couldn't necessarily figure out exactly what was wrong with me. It took a lot of doctors and a lot of money. And during that time, I tried to just calm myself down and deal with my illness by, like, watching birds and feeding squirrels. And I really got a lot of comfort from getting to understand, you know, a little bit about those funny little creatures and the crazy thoughts that go through their head. I mean, they're hilarious to watch.
People also make jokes about it because you and I are in our 50s and a lot of our listeners are in their 30s, and they think that that's what old men do, is sit around and watch squirrels. And we do.
Well, that's kind of true.
I talk about broadcasting from a windowless bunker. I'm actually in a nice room in a brick house in town. I don't live out in the sticks. I'd like to. But yeah, and I have a, you know, enclosed backyard. We have an enclosed backyard, and I have a window right where I broadcast looking out the window. And sometimes I let my cat out there and keep an eye on her. You know, I don't let her roam free anymore. She's too old for that, and I don't know. That's probably not the best thing with cats anyway in town. But she goes out there and watches the squirrels, occasionally kills a bird or a mouse and brings it to me. And squirrels live in a big hole in the tree out in the yard. So good prime squirrel watching when I'm here working the airwaves on the Freedom Fiends. What else have you learned from squirrels, Ben? Anything else? Any other wisdom, squirrel wisdom you can bring to us?
They don't put up with a lot of nonsense from other squirrels or from other creatures, birds, cats, or whatever. You know, an adult squirrel will often stand right up to a cat and you know, back it down. The cat will be starting to attack, and the squirrel will stand up to it. And there's a lot of videos of this on YouTube. And the cat will
there
be like,
"So
dude.
so many squirrel videos on YouTube." Apparently, you and I aren't the only people who like to watch squirrels. There are, there are thousands of videos on YouTube of squirrels doing amazing things. You know, I mean, a squirrel doing something that's even not that bizarre to describe, like getting onto the squirrel-proof bird feeder to eat the seed, is pretty interesting to watch. you have an analogy for, you know, they say in the libertarian paradise, how would you deal with bad people? You deal with them by shunning. And, you know, I mean, really, really, really bad people, you'd probably deal with some kind of courts. But people who are just jerks, libertarians often give them let them slide, which is kind of sad. And I've railed at people against that. And recently I've seen some examples of people not doing that for one of the first times ever, and it's pretty cool. But yeah, a lot of nutty and bad people hide in Liberty and purvey really bad ideas. And a lot of libertarians go, oh, he's charismatic and he's not a statist. I'll listen to him. And part of Status Anonymous isn't just getting over your love of the state. It's getting over clinging to or even accepting the presence. There's nothing wrong with accepting the presence of bad ideas, but that's free speech. But letting them slide, like not saying anything when your friends or even yourself, you know, go, yeah, let's do this or do that. And I've given many examples of what I consider bad behavior. I'm not going to repeat them here. But you have an analogy about bad people, something about the ancient Hebrews did in days of yore. What is it?
Yeah, so just to elaborate on what you're talking about there, Michael, libertarians, or at least ANCAPs and people of our tendency, voluntarists,
our type of squirrel.
Our type of squirrel, we tend to lean on a philosophy called the non-aggression principle or the zero aggression principle. And that means that you are never justified in initiating aggression upon anyone. You can always defend yourself if aggression is brought upon you, but you are not allowed, if you follow the non-aggression principle, you are not allowed to initiate aggression upon somebody else. And we also tend to think that words are not aggression. So if somebody just says, you know, oh, your feet stink or whatever, that's just words and that's not aggression. So, you know, just somebody saying something mean to you is not a reason to hunt them down and beat the crap out of them. So we try to live this, but then there are these times in life where this process kind of falls apart and you get these people who are very, very broken toys and they get among you. And it's really hard to deal with them while maintaining this principle of non-aggression. And so I came up with a story. There's an event that took place during the days of Rome, around 64 AD. The native population around Jerusalem, the Jewish population, and some non-Jews as well, were getting really tired of having Roman rule over them. And it had gone on for about 100 years at that point, although there had been Roman influence even longer than that. And so there was an uprising. And the Romans, in the way that they did, whenever there was an uprising, they just came in like a flood and just started butchering people. And mostly the Jews were forced to flee their native land, including Jerusalem and that area. But there was one group of people that they were called zealots. It's where we get the word now, being a zealot, being a person who's, you know, wildly committed to a particular ideology or whatever. Well, we get that word from this Jewish cult. And I use that specifically because that's what it was. It was an offshoot of Judaism, but it was a very cult-like organization, and they were called the Zealots. And they had some clashes with the Romans, but rather than face, you know, an overwhelming enemy, they fled into the desert, and they took a very old fortification called Masada, and they went into it, took it over, sort of cleaned it up a little bit and put it back into use, and they were going to hold out against the Romans there. And it was quite a, you know, it was quite a palace. It was quite a not only a palace, but it was an old palace what was his name? It'll come to me in a minute. But anyway, it was also a very hardened fortress that was not easy to take over. So the Romans found out about it, and there was about 1,000 of these zealots in the fortress at Masada. And the story that we get today comes to us from a guy named Josephus, and he was an official historian for the Romans. So he had a little bit of a twist in his storytelling, in the fact that he had to maintain his employment. But Josephus tells us the story that there was about 1,000 of these zealots in there, and they held out for maybe a couple of years against an entire legion of Roman soldiers. So we're talking somewhere maybe 5,000 soldiers or so against about 1,000 Jewish refugees that were hiding out in this palace. And so it was so difficult to get to this fortress that the Romans took like a year or so to build a giant rubble causeway to lead so that they could get their siege engines up to the walls of the fortress. And it came down to wrap the story, a long story, to wrap this all up. It got to the point of where the Jews inside Masada realized that all they were doing was buying time, and they were not going to make it out of this. And then the Romans did a really nasty thing. The Romans had captured a lot of Jewish people who were trying to evacuate Jerusalem and the other areas. The Romans had just rounded them up and captured them and then forced them as slave labor to go up and do the final building of the causeway that would bring the causeway up to the walls of Masada. And so the zealots inside the walls discussed this, and they felt they could not fight back. They could not fire, you know, their weapons and arrows and rocks and all the things they had to defend themselves. They couldn't fight against the Roman legions because they would have to kill those slave Jews that were being forced to work. And so they thought, okay, rather than kill the innocent slaves that are being forced to do this, let's reevaluate this. We're going to all die. When the Romans come in, we're all going to die. And they didn't want to ruin their, you know, eternity. They didn't want to do something like kill their fellow Jews. They didn't want to kill themselves because that's forbidden. And so what are they going to do? How are they going to face this? What trick are they going to find? What loophole are they going to find in Jewish law to allow them to not die a horrible, brutish death at the hands of the Romans? And so they came up with this loophole. And the loophole was that they cast lots. It's a sort of a lottery. They had a lottery. And the winners of the lottery would then go into another lottery, and the winners of those lotteries would go into another lottery. And eventually it would get down to the point of where there would be a very small handful of people. And that small handful of those zealots would be tasked with the job of killing all the rest of the zealots, rather than allowing them, women and children and old people, rather than allowing them to fall into the hands of the Romans, who would torture them for sport. They would die at the hands of their fellow zealots. And this was a loophole in their beliefs.
Wow.
And when we get back from the break, I'm going to talk about having a loophole in the non-aggression principle and defending ourselves.
And libertarian indulgences.
Yeah.
Available now by Bitcoin.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Anti-war, pro-free market. That's antiwar.com.
Freedom Fiends. Freedom Fiends. Melting into your brain. So, Ben, you're going to tell us how to get around the non-aggression principle.
So there's always a loophole. You know, any kind of, for example, you know, I'm not a Catholic, and I appreciate anybody who is. I don't have anything against Catholicism or whatever. But Catholicism is a good example. There are loopholes built into it. So, you know, nobody can live the perfect life. So if a Catholic is not able to be the perfect Catholic, there is a process that he can go, and he can confess his sins to a priest, and the priest can assign to him activity or perhaps whatever that will make up for the thing that he's done. And in one way or another, pretty much every philosophy or religion or law system has some type of loopholes so that you can work around the harder edges of the laws. And so that's kind of what we're talking about today in libertarian loopholes in the non-aggression principle. So, for instance, we have joked about giving indulgences, sort of like in the Dark Ages.
Yeah, explain what indulgences were originally, please. Sounds like you were about to, but, you know, go ahead.
Yeah. prior to Martin Luther, the radical German priest that broke away from the Catholic Church
that
back
Martin
in
Luther,
the olden days.
King Jr. and Sr. were named after.
Right, but this was hundreds of years ago. Martin Luther's, one of his things that he complained about was indulgences. And the way that this worked was a priest or a high level like a bishop or a cardinal or specifically the Pope could issue what was called an indulgence. And now what that meant was that you were forgiven for a particular sin. So one of the common ways of issuing an indulgence was if the Roman Church needed an army, they would essentially take a bunch of people who were accused of crimes, and they would give them an indulgence for their crimes in order to get them to volunteer to be a part of this army, and then they would go and march and do whatever armies do. So the indulgence was a way that the Pope could issue forgiveness either for sins that have already been done or sins that were about to be done in the future, and the Pope would forgive you for them. So it's like a free pass, and then you could go ahead and do whatever it was you were going to do. A later version of this that we had also joked about in private between Michael and I and some other people is documented in the story of the Three Musketeers, where the cardinal would issue carte blanches, a blank card, meaning that the holder of this card can use it for a one-time pass to get out of whatever he got arrested for. So, for instance, if you had a carte blanche from the Cardinal Richelieu, then you got arrested for, let's say, murder, you just hand him the card, and, well, you got away with it. But you only got away with that once because you only had one card. So we were talking about issuing indulgences and carte blanches in the Liberty Movement, and, of course, they would have to be paid for by Bitcoin or by tasks. Maybe someone, you know, seeding a torrent.
Yeah, or, you know, sitting in a car watching another car for hours and hours and hours in, let's say, I don't know, the parking lot of the Days Inn in Keene, New Hampshire, maybe.
And we appreciate your service, gentlemen.
Thank you for your service, imaginary people who may not exist, because I don't want to say it. All right, go on.
Yeah, so, you know, this is the story of the Jews at Masada that I was talking about before the break. They were very, very intense in their religious beliefs, and so suicide was not an option for them. Killing the Jews that were building the causeway that was bringing the Romans to them, that was not an option for them.
Roads.
Killing each other was not an option for them. And they didn't want to be taken by the Romans and have their families, the women and the children and old people, just horribly brutalized and tortured the way that they knew the Romans would do. So they came up with a loophole, and the loophole was to draw lots to have this lottery. And the winners of the lottery would then have to be the ones who actually took the hit and did all the slaughter. And so of the almost 1,000 people who died there, only a very small handful of people would, you know, be punished for eternity or whatever it was that they believed, however they believed that that their punishment for that behavior would be. Only a very small handful of volunteers would be the ones who had to suffer that. And as it turned out, according to Josephus, there was about 960 of them died, and 2 women and 5 children were found alive afterwards.
Preach it, Brother Ben, preach it.
Somebody had to sacrifice.
We'll be back.
Somebody had to break the non-aggression fast.
After this trip to the market. And it's basically just the golden rule, so yeah.
Yeah.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, "You didn't build that"? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Freedom Fiends. Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, and myself, MichaelWDean.com, are talking about loopholes in the non-aggression principle. You know, a lot of people say non-aggression principle is absolute and would be shocked and say we're not good libertarians because we're talking about loopholes. But it's not really loopholes in the general sense, because loopholes, when we think of them, you know, with statutory government law, loopholes, as Ian Freeman, Nima Vidati once, it's those phonetics, they kind of rhyme, sort of rhyme. But Nima Vidati once said that loophole, or see, I think he was quoting someone else actually. He said that like something like, loopholes are the portals through which freedom passes. You know, because most loopholes aren't really for things where there's a victim. You know, if you murder somebody, it's pretty rare that there's a loophole that gets you out. But if you're arrested for, you know, some kind of tax thing, or having some pot, or having a gun with 8 rounds in the mag instead of 7 rounds in the mag, you know, hopefully there's a loophole to get you out. But the non-aggression principle is the idea, do not initiate aggression on anyone. Now, I actually wrote a whole book. It's related to using the steps of AA for non-AA things. I wrote it about 5 or 6 years ago. I was kind of green in my libertarianism at the time. I was still a minarchist, but it's a good book. It's called A User's Manual for the Human Experience. And in that book, one of the things I proposed was something called the non-aggression, the NAP 2.0. Or the ZAP 2.0, non-aggression principle 2.0, which is do not initiate, comma, or accept, comma, aggression. Now, that gets into choosing your battles, too. I mean, everybody is aggressed upon in some way all the time. I mean, if you don't pay property taxes, which are aggression, because they're gathered at the threat of the gun or the cage, if you don't pay property taxes, they'll throw you in a cage or kill you if you keep resisting. I pay property taxes, so I will not absolutely have the NAP 2.0 in my life, but I don't put up with a lot of stuff from people, especially in person, in my face. It doesn't mean I'm going to, you know, it doesn't mean if you walk by me and call me, you know, fat or something, I'm going to shoot you. But, it's kind of amazing to me how libertarians and, you know, small government gun people we'll talk all day long about when they'd shoot somebody, almost to the point sometimes of fetishizing it. I think it looks that way to some people, and I think it is a fetish with some people, and it's kind of creepy, but I think with other people, it's just practicing in your mind what you do in different scenarios so you have some inkling of proportional response if you're ever in a life-threatening situation, or something that might look like one but isn't, too. So, you know, nobody really knows what they're going to do if they're prepared for self-defense. Nobody absolutely knows what they do in every situation. There are situations where, of course, people would just shoot the person. But up to those points, there's a lot of gray areas that may have to be decided in a fifth of a second. So it's kind of amazing to me, though, how libertarians will talk all day long about when they'd shoot somebody, but they would never consider punching somebody for something lesser. And I'm not saying it's a good thing to punch people, but Ben, you've punched a lot of people back in the day, didn't you, before you were a libertarian?
Yeah, and not all that long ago either. Yeah, you know,
Wait, you can't like put that bird turd on the table and walk away. How long ago and what are the circumstances?
Let's see. All right. I have to be a little bit vague on this, but the actual last time that what you might even say that I initiated the violence was 2002. And yeah, 2002. And this was a situation where a person had made threats against my family and very specific threats against my daughter. And there was legitimate evidence that he was stalking my daughter, and I just appeared at his house at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and proceeded to very clearly give him bodily instructions as to why that he never ever wanted to deal with me again. And when I got all done, He was committed to the proposition that he would never contact me or any of my family members again. And I initiated that physically based on his words. But I took his words seriously. So, you know, maybe some purists are going to say that I was wrong, that I should not have initiated that violence, that, you know, that what I was doing was not self-defense, that it was all just words or whatever. On the other hand, I couldn't take that chance. I couldn't take the chance with my daughter's life and health to allow somebody who very well might be a really sick, creepy person to do something if all it took was, you know, and I could have, going back to the difference between, you know, shooting and punching, I could have taken it in a different direction, but I chose to specifically to completely disarm myself before I went there to that confrontation. And that was a willful choice that I made because I expected police to show up and I didn't want to be armed when police approached. So I had a lot of thought in this and accomplished it in a way that provided safety for my family, provided a message to the individual involved that he would never want to ever cross that threshold again. And I think I was justified. I think I was playing with the edges of the non-aggression principle, but I think what I did was based on wisdom. If I had waited until he physically initiated aggression, it may have harmed my daughter very permanently, possibly even causing a death or something like that. Who knows what could have happened in a situation like that? So I don't see the law of the non-aggression principle. I don't see that written in stone where we have to have an edict and people, you know, sit around and interpret it. I see it. What was the terminology that that Davi used in reference to traditional? No, what was the word?
Oh, yeah, he said that, and this is really important because this has never been said as far as I know. It's another, like, tiny building block in the road of liberty. He says, the non-aggression principle is not statutory law, it's customary law. And if you search that on The Fiends, you will find the episode where we did that, and it's pretty brilliant.
This is really important, too, because, I've talked before about law and how silly it is to make law into text. So that's like all of what we're told nowadays as law is essentially text. And this is the same way with, you know, no matter what the government does on any level or any government, when they make an edict of any kind that comes out as a law or a statute or whatever, it's written in text. And yet text is like the most horrible
way. It's
like
stone.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they say that. And they say laws are written in stone because, you know, probably because the Old Testament was written on stone tablets, but, you know, which is not, it's supposed to be the law of God, not the law of man. And the laws of man are said to be written in stone, especially when police or judges or prosecutors will not budge an inch on, like, mandatory whatever, or just have their own mental picture of mandatory minimums that are draconian. And remember, draconian was named after the Greek lawgiver, as they called them back then, lawmaker, politician, Drakos, who was basically known for assigning the death penalty to everything, even to, like, stealing an apple. So that's where the word draconian comes from. And that does mean, you know, that is, laws that are written in stone that have no victim, especially, are draconian. Or laws where the punishment far outweighs the crime, like death penalty for stealing an apple.
And that's
or shooting somebody for stealing your paperclip.
Exactly, and that's where I was going to take
that. That's draconian. Yeah, you were going to go there.
That's the silliness of having law as text, because if you write something on text that says, you are not allowed to do X, and then, you know, you're not allowing any room for interpretation, you're not allowed any room for what were the circumstances involved in this or whatever. When you put your law in text, you have just put it into a box and you've limited your capability to have that law as a functional thing. Whereas the best forms of communication are people talking to people one-on-one. And the best form of that is where you're looking at the person's eyes and you're seeing their body movements. And it's a very direct one-on-one communication. But about the worst form of communication is text. So why would we write laws using the very worst form of communication possible, which is text? So when libertarians want to adhere absolutely to a non-aggression principle, the way it's written in stone and the way it's printed in text and the way Murray Rothbard wrote it in the holy text or whatever, you know, what are you really doing? You're making, you're just exchanging the state for another state that's yet to be born. I mean, it's just, it's silliness. You have to bring in some balance. And balance is exactly what Davi was talking about there. The ability to look back in history, to look at the circumstances involved. How has this been handled before? What does our culture generally look at when they see this? And killing somebody over a paperclip is not acceptable. And allowing freaks to come into your private group and disrupt things and steal stuff and intimidate people and just be a general pain, that's not, you're not, you're not, go ahead.
No, you're not.
I was just going to say it's not noble
it's
to
not
tolerate
good.
That.
Yeah. I still say every libertarian group needs one new member all the time who does not yet abide by the non-aggression principle to punch the jerks. And, you know, some could say that's me like initiating aggression by violence, but, and I really don't think that words are a violation of the non-aggression principle. They are a violation of the don't be a Richard principle. And I don't know, in most corners of the world, in any language, being a Richard to somebody in person, in their group, especially if you're coming in as an outsider, gets you punched at least.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, punching somebody, if you don't break their nose or kill them, you know, a punch can kill, but just punching somebody and kind of wrecking their day, and I'm not recommending doing this, especially all the time for anything, but it's kind of been throughout the ages a thing to like even things out when they're too far one way, you know? So it doesn't have to get to guns. It doesn't have to get to swords.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a level of moderation that keeps you from killing people over a paperclip.
Yeah. There you go.
And I'd join the lottery. I'd take up that lottery to see.
Somebody should write an article about why it's okay to punch somebody for stealing a paperclip. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Worms.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
The Central Scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Love the Fiends and want to help out? We do take donations and we put them back into our Liberty Projects. You can make a donation by clicking on the spinning coin on any post. But what if you want to help, but you ain't got no cash? Or you made a donation and you want to help more? Here's how you can help. Download and seed our torrents to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. You can also blog the Fiends and share episode links on Facebook, Twitter, and elsewhere. You can rate and review our movies on Amazon and IMDb. You can rate and review the Freedom Fiends and our songs on iTunes. That really helps a lot. You can buy our movies and share them with friends or give them out as gifts. And one of the best ways to spread liberty is to buy a bunch of Freedom Fiends buttons and give them out as gifts. Wholesale prices are available, and you can also comment on our site, or better yet, comment about us on other sites. And please email the site link to all your friends. Thanks for helping spread the Fiends message worldwide to as many Liberty people as you can, especially to those who don't yet get it. You rock.
Freedom Fiends, tasing you with liberty. It's Michael Dean talking to Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker. Hey, are you still calling yourself the Bad Quaker now that you're done with the Bad Quaker podcast?
Yeah, I guess so. I just set up a Twitter account not long ago.
I'm so happy to see you on Twitter. I hate Facebook, and I love Twitter. Like it says,
Twitter seems to be a lot more civilized.
It really
seems to be less squabbling.
Well,
and fighting
for one
and
thing, you can't write more than 164 characters or whatever, which is actually based on something about like early telegrams. It was like what would fit on one card or something when they typed them out. But yeah, it's one of those things that throws back to old technology, but it's interesting. I like it. And Twitter is, yeah, it's more civil. It's harder to have a beef with somebody. Also, sending messages back and forth to each other, like arguing on Twitter. I've done it once or twice. It's really hard. It's hard compared to Facebook. And also on Facebook, like everybody sees if you're arguing back and forth with somebody on Twitter with instant messages, especially only people that are subscribed to both people see the messages. So you don't get the crowd sitting around eating popcorn and jumping in and helping you out and cheering you on. So yeah, it tends to die quicker, but Twitter's good. So it's better than face beef, or I recently heard it called face beast. I like that. Because it is run, you know, it's not run by the government, but they're tapped into it. They're tapped into everything. But I don't know. I feel more like the CIA or my local sheriff is looking over my shoulder on Facebook than I do on Twitter. Okay, so we were talking about loopholes. I wanted to tell a funny story about a loophole. And this is not a good loophole, but it's a funny loophole. In my first novel, Starving and Company, Beautiful Women, the protagonist, Cash Newman, who's basically me if I were taller and a little more successful in rock music and died of a drug overdose before 30. Cash Newman has this bartender. It's the old thing of, like, you've seen this in a lot of movies, like a lot of the story takes place of the main character telling stuff to his bartender and it being shown his backstory on screen. That's kind of how this book is. And he's Cash is a player. He's got a lot of women in his life, but they don't stick around long, which is kind of how I was back then. And Cash kind of has this deep yearning to be married or be with the same woman and be satisfied, which I am now, and I dig it. So I've done my own think it, do it, be it in my life probably by writing this book. But the book was kind of like a first step for me, the whole book. If you go read Starving and Company, Beautiful Women, you can get it on Amazon used or find it on the Fiends Torrent link. But so basically he has this bartender that has been sober for like 10 years. And the bartender has a really beautiful wife who's really cool, who's been sober for like 5 years. And the bartender sobered her up, which is something a lot of guys try to do in AA and NA. And it doesn't always work. I've seen it fail. I've seen guys buy wedding rings for ladies and engagement rings, and they're in the pawn shop the next day, and she's back out tricking on the corner and sticking needles in her arm. There's a name for that. It's called something like, you're from the Savajo tribe or something like that. But so he's asking his bartender, you know, with the wife sitting there at the bar in the afternoon, no one else in the bar. He's like, how'd you two meet? And he's like, the bartender's like, oh, you know, I met her and I sobered her up. But actually I met her and had that opportunity because of prayer. And he's like, well, Cash is like, well, I don't know much about prayer. I haven't been to that many meetings either. I went once because there was good cookies. But I do remember him saying you're not supposed to pray for things for yourself other than serenity and not getting drunk. And the bartender says, yeah, but I worked out a deal. I had this friend in AA who wanted a good job, and I wanted a good wife. So I prayed for him to get a good job, and he prayed for me to get a good wife. We found a loophole in God. That's the story. So that's it. That's my funny loophole story. And that never really happened, but it was something I actually like thought of my first week or two in AA, like listening in the back of the room, kicking dope, shivering in a blanket by a heater, you know, in a thick coat by the heater in the summer in the back of the, not, there's no heater in the meeting, but in a thick coat in the back of the meeting. So that was my fantasy. And I guess it worked. I guess writing that fantasy worked. So you got about 30 seconds, Ben. You want to conclude here before the second hour?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a human tendency to hack any system that we're up against that stands in our way of getting what we want. And that's kind of what we end up doing with whether it's prayer, whether we're thinking about God or religion, or whether we're talking about, you know, anything else in life that is that prevents you from getting the things that you want. As humans, we're very, you know, we talked about squirrels earlier. It's very much like squirrels. They will figure it out. They will figure out a way to get around whatever obstacles are in their way to get to that bird feeder, because that's in their nature. And humans are the same way. We are hackers by nature. We seek constantly, or at least the most successful of us are. The most successful seek ways to figure this stuff out and get around it.
Yeah.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty Talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's low orbit ion cannon. Hiya, Bob. Hiya, top Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite LibAir 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. I'm your host. I'm your Masters of Ceremonies, Mr. Michael W. Dean. You know, that's what MC stands for. Like, everyone knows rapper name. The rappers, those, the rap musical groups. Always having a guy, you know, MC, Stabmaster, Arson, or whatever. And it's MC stands for Masters of Ceremonies, which comes from back in the day from what hip-hop or rap or the raps music came out of, which was where they would just have, they would just play, they weren't even like scratching the records, they would just play, initially, that came right after, but initially in the 70s, people would do house parties, and they'd have a DJ who would play instrumental tracks. You used to be able to buy 12-inch records that were an instrumental version of a popular song, you know, the song that's on the radio, but without the words, without the singing. And people would toast, it was called. They would toast over it, which was, they would kind of rap over it. They would kind of sing songy rhyme and make stuff up. And the DJ was the guy spinning the records. They were mixing one record to another. And like I said, scratching came very soon after. But they would have, you know, one guy or different guys or different guys and girls come up and be the MC. And actually, like, a lot of times there'd be one main MC and he'd have people come up and guest. And the main MC was called, you know, the Master of Ceremonies, and that's where that term comes from. Did you know that, Ben?
I didn't know the details, but I figured it was something like that because I knew MC stood for Master of Ceremonies.
Yeah. All right, so what are we talking about in this second hour of the Freedom Fiends?
We're talking about Statists Anonymous, which is the what we're using the
It's something the we made up. Which is why it's not on Wikipedia, because one of the rules of Wikipedia is not for things made up in school one day. And this is teaching hospital. So, you know, until it's adopted far more widely. Although, did I tell you that Jim Jesus is working on Statists Anonymous chips?
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know, in AA, they give out chips for welcome chip, you know, 30 days sober, yeah. 60 days. Yeah, but they're going to be guitar picks. And and they're going to, since we can't afford to make a bunch of them for different amounts of time sober, they're going to have a little circle or square in the middle that's going to be white where you can write your sober time in a with Sharpie. You know, you could either write
sober from the...
Yeah, you could either write the date you got sober from the government and quit believing the state, or you could write, you could make, you know, multiple ones and give out 30 days, 60 day, 90 day, you know, 6 months, 9 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 11 years, whatever. So yeah, that's coming, man. You can't stop.
So we're
a good
adopting,
idea.
We're adopting a proven method, which is the 12 steps of sobriety, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 traditions.
There are people there. And this is a 36 part series because we're also doing the 12 concepts of Statists Anonymous. But you know, there are people who argue that AA is not proven. That success rate is horrible. No, this, it's very successful. I've been in it. I've seen rooms full of people who'd be dead otherwise. And it's hard to measure the success rate because it's anonymous. Most people in AA won't answer a survey, you know, because they don't want their boss or whoever to, you know, potential future bosses or anybody, you know, especially if it's drugs, the government, they don't want people knowing like what they're doing, but it is very successful. And, but the thing is, a complaint I've heard about this kind of interesting, it's probably true, is that it looks like science, but it isn't. And that's true. 12 steps kind of look like science. They kind of look like very defined, proven, this is the way this formula works, kind of like math or something. And it's really not. And we've talked about that before. And it requires faith. Even if you're an atheist, you can get sober in AA, or Status Anonymous, you can get sober from the state. But it requires faith in a higher power, which can actually, for agnostics and atheists, can actually be yourself and your fellow man, like, you know, people who've been where you're trying to go and have experience, strength, and hope. And running a problem by a bunch of people and not taking a vote on it, but getting feedback and then coming to a consensus with it. And consensus is a lot more of an indicator of what's true than a democracy is. So, all right, go ahead, Ben. What's step 11?
Yeah, and I
go ahead.
Well, I wanted to mention, too, something that you had said in a previous show, that AA is like the Bitcoin of recovery, because
yes,
it's decentralized. You're not going to a shrink, or you're not going to a clinic and sitting down and giving them thousands
filling out
and thousands
government
of dollars
forms.
And,
yeah. And I would really like to stress that, you know, going to a psychiatrist, which may have its place, but I'm wary of it because it's all has so much government involvement now. But in a free market, there would be paid talk therapists that you'd go to. But yeah, I really don't like it when libertarians and ANCAPs just blanket dismiss 12-step ideology, because they're kind of siding with the state when they do, when they say, oh, it doesn't have the success rate of the Betty Ford Clinic. The Betty Ford Clinic costs $50,000 a month, and you know, your insurance company has stuff like, you're going to be doing it through Obamacare, even if you're rich. I recently got health insurance, signed up for health insurance. We don't qualify for any free money from the Obamacares. Now, you could say, but you're an ANCAP. Why did you even try? First of all, if I'm being forced to do something by the government, I'm going to check to see how little damage I can get. But secondly, to buy insurance through my insurance agent now, and probably all insurance agents, to buy health insurance, you have to go through the Obamacare system.
Yeah, it's like being on the, you know, it's the roads argument. Yeah, okay, so there would be private roads if there was no government to force us to pay for them. There would be systems of roads. But right now, today, the government forces us to pay taxes to build the roads that it has. And therefore, there's nothing wrong with driving on a road that you've been forced to pay for all your life. Same way with healthcare. Same way with Social Security, same way with anything else. You're being forced at the gunpoint, literally, your whole life to support this system.
Yeah.
And so it would be foolish not to, you know, not to utilize the aspects of it that are in front of you.
But we're in this weird middle ground where we really can't afford. My wife gets health insurance through her company, but not for me, because it's a one-person company, you know, one lawyer she works for. So he can't afford to give both of us health insurance. So she gets health insurance. I have to buy it. I've never had health insurance since I had it when I was a kid through my parents, but, yeah, I need it. I'm getting to the age where, like, I mean, I went to some doctors recently cause I was sick. You know, I spent 3 days going to doctors and then got some medication. I spent $1,500. It was like all the money we had in the world, you know, just cause I was having asthma, you know, cause vaping. I'm actually going to quit vaping really soon. I'm sad to say that, but it's not as bad as cigarettes, but I have asthma and I'm getting to the age where, like, I can't be filling my lungs with fluid, man. That's a young man's game. And it's
gonna anything getting in there is disruptive.
It's going to be sad to give it up. But, yeah, so I need to get health insurance so it's not $1,500 if I have to go to a doctor's for a few days. So I got it, or I'm in the process of getting it. But to get it, I actually had to call up the Obamacare health line and talk to them for 40 minutes, give them all my private personal information.
Yuck.
Get asked a bunch of really invasive questions by a government employee who was not nearly as pleasant as someone would be in the private sector. And yeah, so there's that. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the 11th step of Status Anonymous. So go ahead.
Okay, yeah, so the 11th step, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, the first time I read, well, not the first time, but when I read that in preparation for this show, I thought, oh, well, this is going to be an easy one. This one, we'll just breeze right through it. But the more I looked at that and the more I thought about it, the more complex this step really becomes. And it reminded me of the Lord's Prayer, you know, from the Bible. The Lord's Prayer is essentially not, hey, God, I'll do you a favor if you do me a favor. Hey, how about you, you know, let me win this football game or let me win this lottery or what. That's not what the Lord's Prayer is about. It's about God is seeking what God's will is and let God's will be done. And that's kind of what step 11 is. It's teaching you how to utilize meditation to sort of, you know, to me, if somebody asked me, Ben, what do you call meditation? I would say it is shutting up and being quiet and just kind of listening and just sort of letting your mind clear out. I had for a while I carpooled. This was years ago. I used to work in a really nasty chemical company in California. And to try to save money, I was like 30 miles away from it, so a 60-mile commute every day. And so to save money, I went into a carpool, and I was in that carpool for a while until it just drove me nuts. And I got back out of the carpool and went back to riding my motorcycle again. But the problem with riding my motorcycle 30 minutes in, you know, desert, 110, 120-degree desert sun is that it kind of melts your brain. If you wear a helmet, which I always did on long commutes like that, the heat is really intense on your head. But if you don't wear a helmet, then the wind, the heat effect of the hot wind is even worse. So I would wear my helmet, but then I found that coming home in the evening, I was so exhausted that I was a grouch when I got home. And so I started every afternoon when I was riding home, I rode into this little park, and I would pull over and sit underneath a tree, take my helmet off, close my eyes, not like in the lotus position or anything. There was nothing mystical about this, but I would just pull over, park my bike, get off, take off my helmet, sit down in the tree under the shade of the tree, close my eyes, and just be quiet. Not think. If any thoughts came into my head, I just put them out. Don't even think about it. Don't try to solve your problems. Don't try to think about what am I going to do? What's the day going to be like? Just be quiet. And I found that to be unbelievably valuable. I did it to begin with to overcome the heat and not be a grouch when I got home. But within a very short period of time, I incorporated it as part of my daily commute home from work, so that I could shut off all the nonsense of the day and everything that I faced at work, so that I could go home to my wife and kids and be a father and not be a guy that just got home from work. And it was unbelievably valuable to me. And I think that's really the essence of meditation.
Worms.
Worms.
Freedom Fiends.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Hey, this is Squiscar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedom Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed,
buy sheep for sheep on sheep,
and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists.
It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
You should read the step and then discuss it.
Yeah.
Freedom Fiends. Melting your synapses like a brain worm. I'm Michael Dean. I'm talking to Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker. We are discussing the 11th step of Status Anonymous. What is the 11th step of Status Anonymous, Ben, and why should we care?
Step 11 is we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're also looking at the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions from 1953 by Bill W. What's his name? Bill Wilson?
Bill Wilson. Is that it? Yeah.
Yeah. At first, he went by Bill W. because he was anonymous. I mean, the whole thing was anonymous. But, yeah, I want to read just a little segment out of that book that's in reference to this Step 11. It says, "We AA are active folk, enjoying the satisfactions of dealing with the realities of life, usually for the first time in our lives, and strenuously trying to help the next alcoholic who comes along. So it isn't surprising that we often tend to slight serious meditation. So it isn't surprising that we often tend to slight serious meditation and prayer as something not really necessary. To be sure, we feel it something that might help us to meet an occasional emergency, but at first, many of us are apt to regard it as somewhat mysterious of a skill of clergymen, from which we may hope to get a secondhand benefit, or perhaps we don't believe in these things at all." And I think that's really important to understand that what we're talking about here in prayer is not a magic incantation that we can throw out, you know, and say some magic words and poof, smoke puffs up and we get what we want. You know, that's not the purpose of what we're talking about in prayer. And to be honest, I don't actually believe that that kind of prayer works or is real. I think that's just me. And that, you know, I don't mean to offend anybody's religious beliefs, but I just don't really believe that that kind of prayer is effective. I think really seeking what is right in the universe, what is the balance of good and evil, and what are my responsibilities in doing good. And that's kind of, to me, more the purpose of prayer, is to get my mind to focus on what I need to be doing and then let the rest of what works out there, let that take place. Embracing the things that I can change and not worrying about the things I don't have any control over. Another spot in the book that I wanted to read says, "We well remember how something deep inside us kept rebelling against the idea of bowing before any God. Many of us had strong logic, too, that proved there was no God whatsoever. What about all the accidents, the sickness, the cruelty, and injustice in the world? What about all those unhappy lives that were a direct result of unfortunate birth or uncontrollable circumstances? Surely there could be no justice in this scheme of things, and therefore no God at all." But, you know, I was thinking about this, and this is kind of a complaint people have against anarchists. People say, they think that anarchy is some kind of a path to utopia, and a lot of communist anarchists and socialist anarchists have portrayed that at times. But anarchy is not a path, anarchy being no government, that's not a path to utopia, but neither is statism. Statism is not a path to utopia. Statism portrays itself as being, well, the government's going to make all these wonderful things happen, and it always fails. So anarchy is not a path to utopia, but neither is statism. And I don't think that God ever created a utopia. And I don't think God ever promised us a utopia. Religions promise utopias all the time. But, you know, they're selling something. And I'm not selling anything, you know. So I'm not promising any kind of utopia. Anarchy doesn't promise utopia. It only promises freedom. Freedom from an oppressive government. If there's no government, then you're free. And then you only, you know, we're not completely lawless. We still have to, it's just like the situation we were talking about in the previous hour, where within the libertarian utopia, a libpar, as we like to call it, a libertarian paradise, there would still be ways to deal with people who are problem people. And so, you know, the universe is full of random events, pain, destruction, Life itself can only come about at the cost of life. And I know the vegetarians saying, well, that's why I only eat plants. But plants are life. And there's all kinds of bacteria and there's all kinds of little creatures that just because you can't see them doesn't mean they're not there. But life can only exist at the cost of other life. But that's not bad. That's how life is. It's not a utopia.
Worms. 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 If you don't know what worms, go to our glossary. Other than that, if you have to ask, you'll never know.
The Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
For some reason, in this country, and in most of the Western world, it's okay to just judge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created Fiend Phone. I'm using Fiend Phone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about Fiend Phone.
Fiend Phone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try Fiend Phone right now at fiendphone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve Fiend Phone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to fiendphone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's fiendphone.com, FEENPHONE.com. Foxtrot, Echo, November, phone.com.
Fiendphone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
I'm still getting over being sick. This is Mr. Michael Dean, the Iron Hamster, talking to Ben Stone, the Bearded Possum, also known as Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker. He is a Quaker, but as someone pointed out on a blog critical of Ben, Quakers tend to be socialist and anti-gun, and Ben is pro-gun and anti-socialist, so he's a bad Quaker. All right, so,
I also don't go to meetings. I also don't go to Quaker meetings.
But you go to State of Synonymous meetings. You're at one right now.
Yes.
Yeah, and I have said that I think that I've never read this, and I've read a lot about the history of AA. I think that AA meetings are influenced by Quaker meetings because there's no real leader, and people just stand up and talk when they want to, more or less. It's kind of anarchistic in that way, in a good way. And so, Ben, tell us more about Step 11 in Status Anonymous.
Yeah, so I had this other section I wanted to read from the book there. It says, "It has been well said that almost the only scoffers at prayer are those who have never tried it enough." And, you know, that there's kind of some logical flaw in that statement. It's like, you haven't tried it enough, so try it again. And so you can never really say, well, it doesn't work, because the answer is always, well, you haven't tried it enough. So that's a little bit of a logical fallacy. But on the other hand, there's a lot of truth to it. Because, you know, if you haven't, you know, the old saying is, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And that's, you could make the same argument. Well, that's a logical fallacy, because if it didn't work, it didn't work. You need to move on. Don't be just repeating the same thing.
There's a thin line between balancing, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And insanity is doing the same things over and over and over and expecting different results.
Right. But the thing with prayer is that you kind of have to, the first time a person tries it, first off, it feels weird that you're like, I mean, it feels nonsensical to a logical thinking person. It's like, why am I doing this? You know, it doesn't make any sense to your brain. So the first time you do it, it's kind of clumsy and it feels a little awkward. But the more time you spend doing it, the better you get at it and the more refined your mind becomes at being able to just settle down and let your mind think on these things. And eventually, you actually start to see the profit margin involved in letting your mind just relax and really try to figure out what the secret is that you're not letting yourself hear, that you're not letting yourself see. Another part of that book that I wanted to read, Those of us who have come to regular use of prayer would no more do without it than we would refuse air, food, or sunshine. And for the same reason, when we refuse air, light, or food, the body suffers. And going back to my story with, you know, riding home on the motorcycle in the heat and stopping to meditate a little bit before I went home, I came to that conclusion that it was as important to me to stop and meditate a little bit before I went home as it was to go home at all. Because what good am I doing going home as a grump with my head roaring from the wind and the motorcycle? What good am I, you know? But if I can calm down a little bit, and then I get home and the kids come running up to me and they're, "Daddy, look what I drew. Daddy, look what I did. Daddy, look, watch what I can do, Daddy." And I'm no longer just, you know, get out of my way. You know, I could actually calm myself down and relate to them and their little world and all the things that they thought were important and let all that stuff that I thought was important melt away. There's nothing the matter with constructive imagination. All sound achievements rest upon it. After all, no man can build a house until he first envisions a plan for it. Well, meditation is like that too. It helps to envision our spiritual objective before we try to move towards it.
I've heard it said that prayer is talking to God and meditation is listening to God.
That's a really good way of saying it.
I heard that in an AA meeting.
And, you know, what I was talking about there of just being quiet is really, really important aspect of meditation.
I'm being really, really quiet today considering, but I'm still kind of sick, and you're brilliant, and I'm not today, so go ahead. It's hard for me to be really, really quiet. I have a problem. I am not good at meditating. And, you know, my first sponsor said the same thing, and he said, like, to me, meditating is just in the morning sitting down. You know, he said, I'd get up, I'd feed my cats, because when I was a junkie, I couldn't be responsible for anybody else or even myself. So now I have cats. And, you know, I picked a sponsor who had cats, I got to say. And he was like a tough, long-haired, rock and roll kind of biker dude who rode a Harley and played bass, which, you know, is why I picked him as a sponsor. And he was older than me and had a pretty wife, which, you know, come to think of it, I've never really thought about this. I think that the bartender in my book was based on him. And it just hit me. Like, I lived with that book for 5 years writing it. And, like, it just hit me. Yeah, Jeff, the guy, and it's anonymous, Jeff from San Francisco, was the guy, was the bartender in that book. Because he was older and cooler and had what I want, and he was sober, and he had what I want. He had a motorcycle. I didn't want a motorcycle, but he had a Mercedes-Benz and a really hot girlfriend, so he had what I wanted. But more than that, and I didn't realize this, like, I looked at the external, like, oh, he plays bass, he has cats, he has a cool wife, a cool girlfriend, he has a nice car, he has a good job. But also, like, he had recovery and had the time and ability to transmit it to me, which was the most important thing in picking a sponsor, not the external stuff. But yeah, man. So he said that his meditation was, he'd get up in the morning, feed his cats, because he'd do that before he'd do anything, because he felt that was a priority. Like, I have to feed them before I feed me, because I have to be responsible for something else, and I love the cats. So I dug that. And then he said he'd make a cup of coffee and sit on his back porch and smoke a cigarette, because he didn't like to smoke in his house. He lived alone, but he didn't like his house to smell like cigarettes. So he would sit on his back porch and smoke a cigarette and drink his coffee, and that was his meditation every day. And I was like, I can do that. That amount of meditation. I can't, like, sit cross-legged and put my fingers on my laps and you cross them and, like, you know, in a lotus pose and be still. I'm always moving. I'm always twitching. But I could sit down and, like, smoke a cigarette and drink coffee and not talk to anybody. And I kind of do that every day now. I vape, not smoke, and I'm going to quit that soon. But, you know, when I get up in the morning, like, when my wife's here on the weekend, you know, she leaves before I get up usually, or when I'm getting, you know, we're trading shifts in the morning. I'm going to sleep when she's getting up. But when she's here on the weekend, like, she will bring me coffee and do whatever else I need. Can't say on radio. And then she will leave me alone for like an hour. Like, I need an hour to, like, drink coffee, wake up, and answer emails. That's kind of my meditation too. Or just sit alone before I can really even talk to people. Like, sometimes I will call back. Like, if I have an important call I have to make and I've only been up for a few minutes, like I'll call Ben and say, hey, Ben, I have this important call I need to make. Can you and I talk for a few minutes so I'm not stupid when I talk to them? And we do, just, you know, to kind of wake me up. So that's all. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah. So one of the things I was thinking about was in sort of planning out your life and thinking about what your life, where you want it to go and what you want it to be. And even kind of like what you were describing there, you had somebody who you could look at and say, you know, that guy's got the kind of life I want. And that gives you a goal that you can start to work towards. Or like it was saying in the book, you wouldn't go out and just start building a house without some kind of design or some kind of plan in your mind, in your imagination. So it helps to kind of have that vision, that imagination to say, here's the thing that I want. When it comes to sobriety, or whether we're talking about not having to bow to a government, you kind of imagine in your mind, this is the kind of thing that I kind of want. I heard a Freedom Fiend show the other day with Derek and Chandler, and they kind of said that, you know, I'm horribly paraphrasing, but libertarians who are ANCAPs like us and who are, voluntarists and the different labels that we like to put on each other, we have a tendency to kind of be people with a vivid imagination, because we can look ahead and see what the world would be like without having a domineering government breathing down our throat all the time.
It's kind of and statists accuse us of like living a fantasy, but you know, a lot of science came out of science fiction. I think science fiction is an important part of envisioning. I mean, flip top cell phones, the first cell phones look exactly like Star Trek communicators. And you know, sci-fi was always about what the future would look like with science, and a lot of it's come to pass. And I think the same thing's true with discussions. I think people spend too much time talking about the nuances of the non-aggression principle and not enough time talking about, I guess people do talk about, you know, who would build the roads, but I want to get kind of beyond who would build the roads. And that's kind of what the Freedom Fiends is all about. Like, we say this is the radio show that would exist if the government were already out of the way. Like, we don't talk much about what Obama did today, you know. And there's already shows like that, and there's already a very popular show like that that's daily, like The Fiends, Free Talk Live. And what I've said is Free Talk Live, both shows are important, and they're both on terrestrial radio, which is mind-blowing. And they're both on the internet on podcasts, and people listen to them all over the world. But the thing that that I say is that Free Talk Live is the daily newspaper of liberty, and Freedom Fiends is the great American novel of liberty. And I love Free Talk Live. They're very important. But a Free Talk Live episode from 3 years ago sounds really dated, because they're reading the news, and it's historically valuable, but it's like, it's current. It's people talking about what happened today in the paper, basically. Whereas the Freedom Fiends, if you listen to it from 3 years ago, like I often, if I can't do a show that day, I'll put up, we'll play a replay from that week, but then I'll put on the podcast something from 3 years ago. And people love it when that pops up in their feed, because it's timeless, man. I mean, occasionally we'll talk about, like the one yesterday had something like us going like, oh, I think Rand Paul's a good guy. And by now we're like, ugh, Rand Paul, what a statist. But, you know, or we're like, oh, that Molyneux, he's a nice fella. I like his ideas. And now we're like, ugh. But, you know, overall, it still stands the test of time. I mean, I think it'd be listenable in 100 years, whereas Free Talk Live or something that does the Daily Tyranny Report is listenable 100 years from now, only in a historical sense. But they are very valuable. But I'm just talking about, like, what I'm interested in, which is not even just envisioning, like, who would build the roads? We're post-roads. The Freedom Fiends are post-roads. We're imagining we're already in flying cars, and, like, what would talk media be like? There won't be radio, but there will always be talk media, because spoken media is the oldest form of communication, and it's the most powerful. And one person speaking to another is still the most powerful form, and I am speaking to you, listener. I'm in your brain.
Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space. Creamy Radio Audio. Want caviar sound on a cat food budget?
Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out creamyradioaudio.com. That's creamyradioaudio.com.
Redemption in the third act. Give us some redemption, Ben Stone. Take it, brother. Take it.
Yeah. So I want to read another segment of the book here. I've read more of the book in this one in today's show than I think I normally do, but it's because this section was so good in the book. He says, "Perhaps one of the greatest rewards of meditation and prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We no longer live in a completely hostile world. We are no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. The moment we catch even a glimpse of God's will, the moment we begin to see truth, justice, and love as the real and eternal things in life, we are no longer deeply disturbed by all the seeming evidence to the contrary that surrounds us in purely human affairs." And I think this really speaks deeply to what this is that we're doing with Statists Anonymous, because when you start talking to somebody about what the world would be like without governments constantly taxing us, constantly telling us what to do, constantly in our face, you know, observing us, spying on us, influencing everything that we do, twisting the media, twisting news, it seems like that's just overwhelming. But once you can get a glimpse of what the world would be like without it, once you start to see in this sense, in this setting, and I don't mean this in a blasphemous way, but just as an example, once you can see God's will in that sense, the world without a government, once you get the glimpse of it and you begin to see what things could be like, it opens a whole new world in your mind, and it provides a level of peace that you're not going to get this from any great man that you've thought, oh, if we can just get this guy elected, he'll fix everything, or my hero, you know, wearing this cape and coming to my rescue. You don't have to have any of these, you know, great men or any of these superheroes or any of these ideas like that. You don't have to worry about the next election, because what you have in your mind when you are quiet and you can look ahead and you can use your mind's eye and just see what the world could be like without all this influence of aggression and without all of the theft and without all of the layers of bureaucracy, and you start to see the productivity that people have within their own nature, and you start to see people how they really are, the way God intended them to be, and not the way they are today in their rough, gruff exteriors and pushing and shoving and all the things we think of when we think of humanity. All that moves away, and you start to see what polite society is really like. An armed society, a polite society, a kind society, a giving society, a society where 50 to 70% of your income is not stolen by thieves who wear funny uniforms and have all kinds of imaginative titles. The real world that exists or that could exist, that we see with our mind's eye when we are quiet and we think about what the world could be like without government, that's the thing that causes us to see what real truth is and real justice. And it can actually allow us to begin again to love humanity. Because, you know, it's so easy to hate humanity. It's so easy to get your toes stepped on and have a door slammed in your face, and all the stuff that comes with trudging through life. We have all of that stuff that we deal with every single day. And it's really easy to get to the point of where you hate humanity. But to be able to push through all that and begin to understand what true justice is, and really understand that it's not, you know, law is not a thing that men make up and then inflict upon you according to their will. Law is that which is built within each and every one of us. We know what law is. Nobody has to tell a child. You know, if as you're raising a child, as soon as the kid starts to get to an age where he starts to communicate with other people, he starts to understand these concepts of ownership and good and bad. And that's where the mind has to go to, back to that unblemished condition. What do you think, Michael?
I agree, man. And I put a little tiny bit of reverb on you at the end, so you sounded like you were speaking in a church. It didn't really work, so I pulled it back. But yeah, that's what was going on. It's been a great show, Ben. And I value your friendship. Thank you for your service to liberty. And thank you for being my friend.
Thank you, Michael. We're going to get through this.
Through what? Life on this planet?
Yeah.
Full of government?
Yeah.
I like it. I am reassured by you saying that. Thank you. Worms.
Worms.
Give me a worms.
Worms. Yeah.